I'm Earlonne Woods.
I'm Nigel Poor. We're the hosts and creators of Ear Hustle from PRX's Radiotopia.
Ear Hustle is a show about life inside prison, but it's not your typical prison podcast.
In this next season, we've got stories about the objects people keep inside their prison cells.
About residents in a women's prison who say they want to stay there.
And the most beautiful prison garden. Earlonne, I will never forget it.
Ear Hustle. Stories about life on the inside, told by those who live it.
Find Ear Hustle wherever you get your podcasts.
Support comes from Grady Health Foundation, presenting Move for Grady Saturday, April 27th, featuring a family-friendly bike ride through Atlanta's in-town neighborhoods. There's a ride, run, or walk distance for everyone, benefiting Grady Health System. More at moveforgrady.com.
It's August. School is starting up again, but the folks who run things in Georgia have not gotten much of a vacation. They face some very serious questions now. Does this state need tougher gun laws? What to do about hazardous chemicals in the air near some Atlanta area neighborhoods? Whether to expand the state's Medicaid program for low-income Georgians, and how to do all of this when the governor is warning state agencies funding cuts are coming. We'll get into all of that in this serving of The Political Breakfast. Welcome. I'm Dennis O'Hare. Theron Johnson is back. He's a Democratic strategist, public affairs and government consultant, and former National Southern Regional Director for the Obama 2012 campaign. Brian Robinson is away, filling in this time. Former Republican State Attorney General Sam Olens. He's also a former chair of the Cobb County Commission. Welcome to you both.
So good to be here. Thank you, Dennis.
Great to be here, Dennis.
Let's start, of course, with reaction in the state to the shootings in El Paso and Dayton. One idea that has come up is so-called red flag legislation, which would allow courts to temporarily block people from getting guns if they pose a danger to themselves or others. Let's start with the legal side, because there's a legal and a political side to this. Can the state do anything on its own, or is this an area where it is up to the state?
So I think the federal government's role is more if they want to provide grant dollars and use the bully pulpit, but it's a state issue. And clearly the discussion is compliance with due process, having an appropriate standard such as clear and convincing evidence, and requiring that promptly there will be a court hearing with the party who would be losing the weapons having the ability to show that they should be able to retain them.
Is it time for the state to take another look at this?
Look, I think the state needs to change its laws. You know, the GBI for years supported changing Georgia law where after 5 years you purge the records of folks that lost the right to have a weapon because they were involuntarily hospitalized due to mental illness. That's ridiculous. There's nothing magical about 5 years. It should require that you get documentation from a doctor. And upon that documentation from the doctor, you potentially would then regain that right.
Yeah, because the purging after 5 years is kind of arbitrary, I think is what you're saying.
Well, and frankly, dangerous to society and dangerous to law enforcement.
Well, I'm very happy to hear Sam, who's a good friend of mine, actually speak out and say that the state not only needs to revisit this, we need to change the laws. And I think that if you just look at what happened, unfortunately, in these other states, you know, we're not immune to something similar or worse happening in Georgia. And God knows that we don't want to be caught flat-footed when this happens, if it were to happen in Georgia. But if you really look at what the former attorney general just stated to us is that while I do agree with him that this is something that the federal government has to rely on the states to do, I do feel that the federal government has a role. And if you look at what Congressman McBath has done, she is
Lucy McBath, incumbent Democratic congresswoman in the 6th District.
You're right. And then also if you couple that with a new state representative, Matthew Wilson, mm-hmm. who introduced House Bill 435.
And who was on Closer Look. Just recently.
And did a fabulous job. And then also, if you look at what State Senator from here in Georgia, Jen Jordan, introduced mm-hmm. Senate Bill 150, while it doesn't necessarily go as far with the red flag as Representative Wilson's bill, you do have bills that are actually going to be on the docket to be reviewed for this upcoming legislative session. And so I want to commend Sam for saying what he just said, and I hope that the current Attorney General, Chris Carr in Georgia, and also the governor and the speaker and the lieutenant governor all listen to what we're saying and try to get with these Democrats and start having conversations now before the session begins.
But there's a follow-up to that legal question, though, which is suppose the state passes some kind of gun law and suppose that Governor Kemp signs it, which is by no means a given. Even then, would it survive a challenge which might go to the U.S. Supreme Court, which has already been very friendly to an expanded interpretation of the Second Amendment?
So I don't think it's as expanded as you stated. Generally, when the Supreme Court rules on these issues, it's very fact-specific.
Mm-hmm. And there is the Heller case, which
right.
says people—
You take extreme facts and then you create a decision to match those extreme facts.
But it gave a lot of latitude for people who want to own handguns.
Right. And former Justice Scalia oftentimes voted with the liberal wing that there was a point where it was appropriate to have such restrictions. You know, clearly there will be a challenge. Georgia Kerry has already stated that anything new they would fight, which isn't a surprise. So clearly it's going to need to be worded well. You're going to need the expert at Chris Carr's office to assist.
And Georgia Kerry, we should note, has a very impressive string of victories in the courts, particularly when it challenged some City of Atlanta gun legislation about guns in parks, for instance. I remember sitting in a courtroom where they made their case. The city got up and the judge basically looked at the city attorneys and said, why are we here? I mean, this is open and shut, and ruled in favor of Georgia Kerry.
Facts are important.
Anyway, I interrupted you there, but continue with what you thought.
Well, no, I just think that there's clearly going to be a challenge, but if you provide appropriate due process, if you provide a stringent standard, then I think these bills can in fact pass constitutional muster.
Back to the political question, though, Theron, do you think that Governor Kemp will sign any of these? I mean, this is the guy who had a campaign commercial with him carrying a shotgun sitting next to a young man.
Well, I think that the governor and his staff have to look at the level of humanization to this political and legal challenge for our state. Sam just did a wonderful job of explaining the legal pathway, so let's get to the political. You're right. The NRA plays a very, very pivotal role, not only in elections in Georgia, but all over this country. And what we've seen is, from some Republicans, not all, a hesitation to come out and really speak some of the things that we just said, because they're, I think, afraid of a large part of the Republican base, which are people who truly believe in the Second Amendment, and they don't want their guns taken away from them. So they're adamantly opposed to gun control. I think what the governor is going to have to really look at closely is what's going to be the sort of tone and tenor in the legislature. Mm-hmm. And then I think also they're going to have to talk to some sensible Second Amendment supporters that are not going to come in with sort of a roadblock in their minds and saying, I don't want to support any measure that take away my guns.
And the governor has kind of taken a wait-and-see attitude here.
He has. Now, one of the things that I've done this week is that I've talked to some of my friends, Democrats and Republicans, who are big, you know, in gun rights and gun owners and support the Second Amendment. What I found very interesting, Dennis, is that in talking to all of them, these men and women, is that they do not support anyone who clearly has been identified with a mental illness to have unlimited access to guns. And so when I asked them specifically about the red flag issue, I feel that there's an appetite there from them.
What about background checks, though? I want to ask you both really quickly. Well, is the political will there for that in this legislature with this governor?
Well, you remember the background checks conversation really was on a granular level and the federal level. And President Trump at that time said that he would explore background checks and even sort of hinted that he may explore looking at red flags.
And he has reversed himself on that a couple of times now.
So in typical President Trump. So now, background checks, absolutely, you've got to now bring that to the forefront. And the last thing I want to say is this. I just think that to take partisanship out of it, the one thing that I think that strikes me the most is that this has really been so repetitive. And we can't blame all this on the president. I want to say this as a Democrat. But he does share the responsibility for some of the rhetoric, some of the tweets, and some of the language that he's used previously up into these, you know, mass domestic terrorism shootings that has, I think, aided and abated some of these folks. But absolutely, Dennis, I'm for full background checks. I'm for the red flag. And I do think that Republicans and Democrats just can't offer prayer and condolences. We got to basically come back with some really good policies to make sure this doesn't happen again.
So I think you need to, once again, narrow where both sides will agree and pass a bill rather than have another year. So as an example, I think you could have a discussion about background checks for online purchases. If you want to have a discussion about between family members, I don't think that's a viable option. So I'm more about, consistent with Darren's comments, let's see where people will agree. Let's make some iterative change where the majority's comfortable rather than having nothing new occur.
What I want to do is I want to challenge a Republican, he or she, to bravely come up and basically say what Sam just said, is that, hey, I'm not going to compromise my Second Amendment rights, but I'm willing to have a conversation, a sensible conversation about where we can meet. I think therein lies an opportunity for the Republican Party. Now, the Democrats are going to have to also, once we get all our rhetoric out and we kind of appeal to our base, there's an opportunity for a sensible Democrat to come up and say, you know what, maybe we can't do everything that's been proposed, but I'm willing to sit down with this Republican to really have a conversation to get something done this year.
No, I agree. I mean, look, I have guns. I'm not against the Second Amendment, but I think there are areas we can agree on.
Is the will there, though, do you think, in this legislature with a presidential election year coming up, is the will there to do something this coming session?
I'm not optimistic.
And that's really, you know, Sam is a man who speaks truth to power, but I think that, again, if he's not feeling optimistic, that doesn't make me more optimistic, obviously, but I do think that it's got to be someone in leadership on the Republican side and Democratic side that can come together and start this conversation. I truly believe that Georgians deserve that.
Real quickly, before we leave this subject, let's go to Washington for a moment. Georgia Democratic Congresswoman Lucy McBath, as Theron mentioned, has sponsored a bill, kind of a red flag bill, if you will. Can she, Mr. Olens, put GOP challengers or potential GOP challengers on the spot in a district where moderate voters, even many Republicans, might favor some kind of moderate legislation?
You know, frankly, that's already occurred. She already has talking points to assist her next November. She doesn't really need more.
And of course, she lost her son to a gun attack. But Republican campaign committees have had to kind of backtrack because they accused her of capitalizing on a tragedy to raise funds, referring to the El Paso and Dayton shootings. But of course, in the background is her own story. So it was a little bit of a political misstep to accuse her of that.
I think anytime an elected official seeks to raise monies after a national tragedy is poor timing.
Yeah, but the thing I want to push back on that, Dennis, is that I don't think that she did anything wrong because she based her campaign on striking a level of humanization with the voters in the Congressional 6th District here in Georgia. And so you're right, Dennis, they've had to kind of backtrack on that. Now, I think what Lucy McBath and her congressional staff and her campaign staff are going to have to figure out as a healthy balance where you don't go too far. Because let's not forget, she didn't win that district by being far left. And then she didn't win it by being far right either.
The margin's going to be very small no matter who wins that
but
district.
But I do think that the people who are running against her on the Republican side better have a message around what they would do if elected to Congress to deal with this gun safety and gun control issue we have in our country.
Switching subjects for a moment, some remarkable reporting by Georgia Health News and WebMD revealed that a medical sterilization plant in Smyrna submitted emissions data that showed an elevated risk of cancer to some of the nearby neighborhoods, but neither federal nor state environmental officials told the neighbors about it. And it also turns out that the company stopped reporting in 2016 because it said its emissions had declined to a level where it didn't need to report anymore, but you're relying on the company. Mr. Attorney General, in a case like this where we're talking about not just the Smyrna area but Covington as well, where people are really concerned, does voluntary reporting actually make sense for a state that's trying to keep track of a lot of industries that produce hazardous chemicals?
No. It's pretty clear. It's a nonpartisan issue. You protect the citizens. You know, what was interesting is when I was chairman of COB, the Public Safety Department literally had maps and data around the county with regard to any dangerous chemicals. And their concern was what happened if there was an explosion, if there was a fire. they wanted the fire department to immediately know what those folks were walking into for their personal safety. And if the companies are not sharing that information, then you're putting affected residents, public safety, everyone at risk. And there's no place for that.
But is there an or else that the state can even use if the Environmental Protection Division is saying, hey, we like voluntary reporting?
Well, if I were a legislator right now, I'd be seeking to change that legislation.
And Jen Jordan, whom we mentioned a moment ago, a state senator whose district include parts of Cobb, is doing that, Theron.
And also State Representative Eric Allen, who is a newly elected state representative in Cobb, has spoke out about this. And what State Representative Allen has said is that self-reporting is no longer an option. Now, I'll be honest with you, as a citizen who lives in the Atlanta area, this is not something that just affects Cobb County. It affects all of us in this state.
Well,
right?
And the area around Covington and Newton County has had a similar issue.
Absolutely. And so I had sort of a very, emotional reaction to this, and that was, listen, fix it. You know, this is something that we should all be alarmed about. But I think where it's moving to and what I'm hearing is that the governor's office and APD feel like this company has gone above and beyond and has done some good job of reporting these things. And we do, as you just reported, mentioned
that. But the neighbors never heard about it.
So herein lies what Sam knows is rule number one is, when did you know it? What did you do when you knew about it? And how did you communicate it to your constituents? And I think they failed in that. Now what the conversation is going is, how can government independently monitor the steps going forward from now? Because I do think that, to Sam's point, the legislature is going to jump all in on this. I mean, there are already two people in the legislature on the Democratic side talking about this. Now I think that the governor's office and APD, working in concert with EPA, are going to have to figure out how they give the public the trust that everything is going in the right direction.
EPD is the State Environmental Protection Division. EPA are the feds, the Environmental Protection Administration.
So I think you frankly have seen the governor take quick action, seek to be ahead of the issue, which I certainly commend him for. And I think that, frankly, the state just needs to keep up the pressure and do everything possible. When you see those census tracts, my God, would you want to live in one? No. I mean, that's human nature. Unfortunately, I don't think the city and county were fully apprised of the potential danger. And at the same time, you've got trial lawyers already saying, hire me. So there's going to be a need for much more information.
Which will take more monitoring and more money, and this comes as the governor is telling agency heads to look at cuts of 4% for their budgets for the rest of the current fiscal year and 6% for the fiscal year that's going to start next July. So when you're looking at whether it's environmental monitoring, whether it's the new voting machines in case something goes wrong, whether it's infrastructure, whether it's education, where there is a continued push for more funding, whether it's rural broadband, we've got needs for increased spending. How is the governor going to be able to keep that juggling act going?
The one thing you got to give this governor credit for is that he has made it a point to deliver on his campaign promises. One of the things that he promised on the campaign was to, if he were elected governor, to cut wasteful spending, which he would view as wasteful spending. And he also said that he would be a fiscal conservative. And so while the timing, to your point, Dennis, is very, unfortunate, I do think that this is something that probably his staff planned to do immediately after the session ended. And so he's got to answer questions to his base and also to all Georgians. Hey, you made these campaign promises. Where can we cut? Now, I don't think that the governor is saying universally he's just going to cut everything. I think what he's going to do is put these department heads on notice and say, hey, come back to me on where we can make cuts. Then you get into the politics of prioritizing the cuts, and then you got to message that to your voters. You got to message that to your legislature, and then your leadership on the Senate and the House have got to go out and sell it as well.
You anticipated my next question, which I'll direct to the former attorney general here. You've headed an agency. When a governor says we want 4% cuts, it sounds like, oh, we're just going to cut 4% across the board. Does that even make any sense?
So, the governor used discretion, and there were certain agencies that were told maybe you need to do more, and there were certain that he knew could not afford that 4% cut. You know, for instance, there came a point where the GBI just did not have sufficient resources, you know, closing crime labs, losing agents.
The backlog on rape kits, for instance.
Yeah, absolutely. But I think the governor is right that there is waste and that there is room for improvement. I mean, when I was there, the governor, Governor Deal, did request cuts. Cuts occurred. Look, you show me a large agency and tell me that you can't cut anywhere, and I'll tell you you're wrong. There are always areas in government you can cut, but let's use common sense and prioritize those areas. So I certainly have no problem with him saying that he wants the cuts, and I think they can, in fact, find areas to cut.
But the devil will be in the details. Will the areas where he eventually finds ways to cut in the budget that he'll submit to the legislature, will all of those cuts add up to the 4% that he's told the agency heads that he wants? Or when you start looking at, okay, Medicaid expansion, which we're going to get to in a moment, and you look at the other expenses that I talked about a moment ago, not to mention all the ones that may come up, can he even do that? Is 4% or 6% next year realistic?
Let's give him the opportunity.
Theron, Democrats are going to be saying, hey, look, you know, there are needs in this state, particularly in rural areas where we've talked about rural development, where we've talked about rural broadband, where we've talked about rural infrastructure, that are going to be hugely expensive, not to mention education, where you've just had $3,000 raises for teachers.
What you just laid out is a campaign flyer that when these cuts go through, that no matter where the governor makes the cuts, because I agree with Sam, I think that he's made it very clear that he wants these agencies to really look long and hard at when they can cut. But yeah, I mean, it's going to be a battle between, does the cuts help or hurt people in rural Georgia, which we know was a big part of his base of support. And also,
and a big part of his campaign.
Absolutely. And then I think that, listen, but I want to say this. Yes, if the shoe was on the other foot and it was a Democratic governor, Republicans will be gearing up to talk about whatever cuts that Democratic governor makes. So, yes, I think the Republicans are anticipating the Democrats to kind of poke holes at whatever the cuts are. What I think is going to be different this time is that I think this governor is going to have to sort of now sort of have a communication strategy of how he communicates these cuts to the public, but also how does he get his leadership? I keep going back to that. How do you present it to the legislature, and how much involvement will they have in the willing and dealing that goes on with these budget cuts?
The governor's had a very cooperative and collaborative style. The governor's appointments, for instance, have been unbelievably popular. The number of minorities, the number of opportunities he's providing around the state are fantastic. While some folks clearly dislike his politics, you've got to love a lot of the things that he's doing for us.
What you're saying is true. Even some Democrats have praised some of his appointments. How surprised were you after the campaign that he ran, particularly in the TV ads, that it turned out this way?
I don't think you judge people, frankly, by comments made during a campaign in the height of the moment. I think you judge them
by their
actions.
But you're supposed to believe them when they're campaigning, aren't you?
We just had an apology by a failed candidate for governor who said he wished he didn't say a lot of the things he said.
Yes, that's true. But he's got legal problems of his own. Anyway, Theron Johnson?
No, listen, I've been very complimentary of this governor because, like many of us who know him for decades, what we saw during the campaign, many Democrats and some Republicans didn't like. But I think at the end of the day, Sam is right. What he's shown since day one, I mean, I'm the same guy that gave him an A- in his first 100 days, and Democrats were very shocked, and because I based it on his campaign promises. And so you're right. Not only has he been collaborative, I mean, he has made some appointments. But not only that, I mean, he has a different leadership style where his staff is a little bit more of an open door policy. And I'm not saying you couldn't walk into Governor Deal's office and meet with his staff, but this governor, from what I'm hearing from electeds and folks like me who are being put in a position to work with this governor's office as a lobbyist, I mean, they will at least hear you out and then you get responses. And so it's definitely been refreshing to see that this governor is at least willing to listen. And by the end of the day, I think he makes his own decisions. And then when he makes them, what we found is that when you criticize him, he doesn't back away from it. And he basically says, hey, this is what I told you I was going to do. So again, I think this budget deficit conversation is another campaign promise that he made that he said he was going
to
do.
Let's come back to two structural questions about the budget before we move on to something else. This is coming as the state is cutting the top income tax rate from 6% to 5.5%. And the governor cited declining state revenues as one of the reasons he's asking for cuts to spending. So again, looking at the punch list of things that need to be done and where money needs to be spent at a time when the state is voluntarily cutting its own revenue and the economy is showing signs that maybe the state's revenue will decline anyway, how much sense do these cuts make?
So candidly, I think the governor's got the ability to make cuts, and I'm not so concerned about it.
When I talk to people who have basically been looking at this economy from a very broad standpoint, we know that the Trump tax cut has been mostly funded on deficit spending, right? And so now was the first time where we were like, okay, here we go. Is the Georgia economy as good as we think it is? And I think that, yeah, we're still heading in the right direction. I think that we're still the state, one of the best states to do business. But I do think the governor is to be commended because he's looking at the trends. And he's saying that, I think not just in Georgia, but, you know, we may be on the verge of a national recession if the president, with the deficit spending, the zillions and trillions of dollars that we're in debt, if that sort of trickled down to the state. So, you know, listen, I think this is where the governor is going to have to bring in some financial experts and really going to have to forecast this, not just for this upcoming year, but for years to come, especially during his first term.
I just wanted to clarify, when I asked how much sense do these cuts make, I wasn't talking about the spending cuts. I was talking about the cut in the income tax rate, just so folks understand that. Real quickly, though, there was interesting timing for the governor's warning because it came as the feds were telling Georgia and other states, we don't like the Medicaid expansion waiver plan that Utah put together. The Utah plan is very similar to one that appears to be in the process anyway for Georgia, and it appears the feds rejected Utah's before that one was even put together. So we're back at square one with a Medicaid waiver expansion. In the meantime, we're losing revenue that we could be getting from the feds. Isn't that correct?
So the sky isn't falling. The fact of the matter is we have some really bright minds in Georgia. We have folks that really understand healthcare. The governor's got a really solid relationship with the president and the vice president. And I frankly think they'll solve the problem.
The one thing that's unclear for me, and maybe Sam can answer for me, because Lord knows I don't want to get into a legal discussion without having my lawyer right next to me. But when I first heard this news, my initial reaction was, as a Democrat, hey, this is another opportunity for the governor to fully expand Medicaid, right?
Yeah, that's where I was going.
Then, you know what? I'll try to be a sensible Democrat, you know, more moderate. You know, I'm from Athens, so I get a pass sometimes. But then I said, well, okay, is this an opportunity for the governor to what Sam just talked about? Great relationship with the president, vice president. Got two U.S. senators, one of whom, Senator Perdue, I think is probably, you know, got tremendous access to this president. Are we looking at what happened in Utah? Here's my question to Sam and you, Dennis. Does Georgia have an opportunity to analyze why the federal government, i.e. the Trump administration, turned down Utah? And then do we have an opportunity to go back and modify a little bit and say, okay, this is what you didn't like? Or there are some critics that are saying that they threw it out because they just don't want to deal with it at all. They don't want any waivers. And so that's kind of a question that I'm really trying to figure out, even for our listeners. I don't know the answer to that.
And if I recall, the legislature, Mr. Agee, did give the governor a lot of leeway when it comes to putting together a waiver plan, didn't they?
Yes, it did. And once again, you know, you've got folks like Tom Price that know healthcare inside and out, that still have a lot of contacts in D.C. You've got some real bright minds here. And I'm willing to give them the benefit of the doubt that they can come forward with a plan that will work.
But it's been so many years already. A cynic might say, well, since Obamacare became law and the state said we're not going to expand Medicaid under Obamacare, and then for years there was talk under the previous administration of putting together a waiver plan, which didn't happen.
Look, the waivers under President Obama came with the condition that after several years, it was solely the federal government's decision whether to retain the waiver program or to bind you to the full program. That was a killer for many conservative states. Let's give this governor the opportunity to try and make a good deal for us.
And there's a lot more to come in this edition of The Political Breakfast. It isn't just state government that's been busy lately. The city of Atlanta is facing questions about how it handled some airport money. We'll be back with that and more as The Political Breakfast continues. Stay right here.
You love free, and at Ameris Bank, so do we. That's why we're proud to offer worry-free, hassle-free Ameris Bank free checking. Manage your money your way with convenient access to digital, mobile, and telephone banking, all with no monthly service fee or minimum balance requirements. At Ameris Bank, we're with you. For more information or to open an account, visit our local bankers in person or online at amerisbank.com/free checking. Other fees such as overdraft fees may apply. Ameris Bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender.
And we are back with the Political Breakfast. Thanks for hanging around with us. I'm Dennis O'Hare. Democratic strategist Theron Johnson is back and filling in for Brian Robinson this time, former state attorney general, Republican Sam Olens. Let's talk about the new voting machines that the state is putting in. Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger got the contract awarded to Dominion Voting, $107 million worth of new voting system, which includes paper ballots. And the Secretary of State says everybody can be confident in this. Some voting rights advocates have said, maybe not so much. Hard to tell until it actually goes into effect, but there's not a lot of time to do that. The March 24th primary is going to be the beginning of it.
Well, there's some opportunity this fall to have a couple test sites. I frankly support the type of machines that were approved. I don't understand why people don't remember about the fiasco in Florida and pregnant chads.
The hanging chads.
So I much would require that paper backup. But the old days with paper ballots alone, I just don't see as viable.
You come from Cobb County, and if I remember correctly, I'm going back into the dusty memory vaults here, but if I recall, Cobb County at one time had something a little bit like what we're going to, which was an OptiScan system. In Cobb County's case back then, you filled in a little bubble by hand, and then a computer read it. This time, the machine fills out the little bubble, and then it reads it. Sounds as if you, coming from Cobb County, based on your experience with somewhat different yet similar system, have a lot of confidence in it.
Yeah, I want to assume that everyone's done a thorough job. I want to assume that that paper ballot backup is a very good opportunity for the state and that this will work well.
The first thing we got to do, Dennis, is that we've got to acknowledge that there were some voting problems and some voter irregularities. And Lord knows, if Brian was here, then if I said voter suppression, he would just lose it. So I won't go that far today. But
well, when he listens, he can lose it.
Absolutely. Who knows where he is, in the world. So starting there, this I want to commend the Secretary of State, Secretary Raffensperger, for coming out and sort of saying, hey, you know, there are some things that were reported that we need to fix. And more importantly, let's work with our local county officials to fix some of these challenges. Now let's move to this new machine. This Secretary of State had to do something, right? You could not walk into those elections with the same machines because we know that there's not an appetite for that. The thing that I struggle with is that the taxpayers of Georgia are going to spend $107 million on a new machine that, to me, has striking similarities than the old machine.
Because it's a touch screen.
Right, it's a touch screen. And yes, we do get a paper printed ballot.
But the machine does that.
But the machine does that, right? And so if the goal is to make sure that Georgia voters feel that our elections are secure and fair, then I don't know if this went far enough. But I agree that going totally back to a paper ballot, which many Democrats in this state have called for, I'm not all the way there yet because I do believe that we have to have some 21st century innovation. And I do believe that as we continue to move forward, there's got to be a communication component to this. So I would hope that this Secretary of State would do like the former Secretary of State, now the governor, and get around the state and educate the voters and have some tests. You know, take them to the senior centers. You know, my mom lives in Athens, Georgia. She's about to be 75 years old. She's going to be mad at me for saying her age on the podcast. Mm-hmm. But the more familiarity she has, the more comfortable she is with what she will endure once she goes in to vote, I think is an opportunity here for the Secretary
and
of State.
And voting education, either the cities or the counties or the state are going to have to pay for it. I keep coming back to that issue. We keep expanding the shopping list. When where's the money going to be for it?
Look, as a resident of Cobb County, those folks should be at every Rotary, Kiwanis, Optimist, Chamber, Business Association meeting.
Fish fry.
Right.
Do you have fish fries in Cobb County?
Yeah, we do, but I'll get myself in trouble, but I'm not a real big fan of catfish. Not at all. don't. But, you know, there are the opportunities for them to get out there and specifically go to senior centers, et cetera. And I think the Secretary of State's committed to doing that. I think local elected officials are committing to do it. You know, look, you can whine or you can do. And I think the better governments do.
A couple of quick political notes before we head to the city of Atlanta. In previous editions of the Political Breakfast, as Theron knows, we've talked about the prolonged wait among Georgia Democrats to see if Sarah Riggs Amico, former candidate for lieutenant governor, would announce a bid for U.S. Senate. Well, now we have some idea about one possible reason for that delay. The car hauling firm that she heads has filed for bankruptcy protection. Theron, I imagine she's been a little busy lately, but does this affect her decision on the Senate?
I think that what she had to do, and I've gotten to know Sarah pretty well, is that, you know, if you meet her, Dennis, and you talk to her, I mean, the first thing that really strikes you is that she's not your typical person who wants to aspire to be U.S. Senator, meaning she's not a sort of career politician. But here's the challenge, which, you know, I want to be fair on this podcast, is she sort of based her campaign for lieutenant governor of saying, hey, I'm a business owner. I give health care to all of my employees. I can bring a sort of a business-minded approach to state government.
And the bankruptcy filing cited labor costs as among the many reasons why the company is filing for bankruptcy.
Right. So what I hope she's done is hire someone that can come out here and spin this. You know, if Brian Robinson was so busy in Iowa and doing all this stuff and spending time with Republican candidates, he could probably give her some advice. But I don't think that this eliminates her opportunity to run. I do think now she's pushed back her announcement, obviously, for one of many reasons, if we think this is part of it. So now she's got to recalibrate and figure out, okay, when she announces, because I still think she's going to run. What's going to be your answers to the public and to the press around this issue?
But, Mr. AG, can the Republicans really go after her on a bankruptcy filing when the president, at the top of their ticket, has had more than a few of those?
Look, I haven't frankly seen where those attacks work. And I'm talking over the years, I haven't seen where those attacks work. It makes for good fodder. But, you know, at the end of the day, it's the quality of the candidate and their ability to relate to the voters that matters.
Another quick note, former Cobb Democratic Chairman Michael Owens, a sometime guest here on The Political Breakfast, is challenging veteran incumbent Democratic Congressman David Scott in a primary. And Congressman Scott's been a frequent visitor also to the WABE airwaves. Congressman Scott got a shout-out this week, Theron, from Senator David Perdue, who talked about him as one of the folks he admires in Congress in a bipartisan way. Now, Congressman Scott may certainly appreciate that personally, but is that what he needs in what's probably going to be a primary fight?
I do think that there is an appetite for voters to see that Republicans and Democrats can work together. And I think that's where Congressman Scott welcomed that comment from David Perdue, who, when he first got to office, it was a person who I think made several gestures like that to Dems. And for a long time, he hasn't been looked upon in sort of like Isaacson, who consistently works with Democrats and compliments them. But where you're going with this, Dennis, which is why it makes you one of the best in the business, is that does this help you in a Democratic primary? But what Sam will probably say is that Michael Owens, who's a young, energetic candidate for Congress, has got to be careful because David Scott is revered in Washington. He's a proud blue dog Democrat. He brings resources back to his district. And look, he has also called out Republicans when he felt that it was necessary. So while that district is Democratic, and having a nod of a good working relationship from a U.S. senator, I don't think it hurts him, but I think it could be managed.
The most votes in the 13th are Cobb County. And what David Scott does unbelievably well is constituent services, his job fairs, his out in the community. He is an old-fashioned politician that kisses the baby, shakes the hands, gets out there. He doesn't spend all his time in D.C. He gets out with the constituents. I'm a big fan of his. You know, when I was chairman of the county, I relied on him numerous times for that bipartisan support to get things done in D.C. for the benefit of our county. And I have nothing but good things to say about Michael Owen. But I do think some of his attacks on David Scott are frankly pretty sharp. And I'd probably tone it down a little bit.
Yeah, what's going on in the Democratic Party, and Dennis, you remember we talked about this once before, is that you have a younger progressive wing of our party, which I think Michael sort of represents. But, you know, you have a person like David Scott, who is a person who came up through the ranks, started his career at the state level, won this district in a very competitive primary. So he's not one that shies away from a fight. I think at the end of the day, it's going to come down to resources. And if Michael can garner enough money to amplify his attacks, if he continues, I'm not telling him how to attack a current incumbent congressman, but I do think he has to be careful, because this member of Congress, as Sam just talked about, is one that honestly has not only just great constituent services, but as a person who has really been able to connect with these voters for a very long time and has a really, really big base in Cobb County and all the other counties that represent the 13th district.
One thing I would say, and I'll be interested in Theron's comment, often these younger Democrat candidates, from my perspective, are not spending enough time with the older constituents, and too much of the race is the younger folks that they're seeking to focus on. And I think sometimes their efforts are too one-sided towards the younger electorate, and they need to spend more time with the older electorate.
That's a great question, Sam. And listen, I'm one, you know, who I say this all the time, Congressman John Lewis is my hero. But you're right. You can't go run into these districts, and particularly in Congress, and not sort of, we don't want to say kiss the ring, but you got to pay respect and you got to at least make the attempt to reach out to them. But Sam, this is something that we're challenging with the Democratic Party. We have younger voters who are living in these districts, but they're not registered. And even when they are registered, they're not coming out and voting in a higher percentage than more of our seasoned voters. And so the person who I think can put together the best campaign will be able to have a confluence between both, locking down your base with older, seasoned Democratic voters, but also appealing to these younger, more progressive voters as well.
I like that phrase, seasoned voters. Very quickly, we promised to talk about the City of Atlanta. The FAA has said the City of Atlanta improperly diverted airport funds for other purposes, which the rules say you can't do. Money comes in from the airport, you got to spend the money on the airport. And among the expenses there was $90,000 that went to a consulting firm founded by former Atlanta City Attorney Kathy Hampton. Theron, it's just almost water torture for Mayor Bottoms. How does she get past, or does she get past, the constant drip, drip, drip of alleged improper activities, or in some cases where charges have been pled guilty to, at City Hall?
A few things I want to make clear. Number one, this is, yes, a new part of the investigation, but it's been an ongoing working relationship between the FAA and the City of Atlanta. That's number one. Number two, this mayor, Mayor Keisha Lance Bottoms, I believe has been the most transparent mayor we've had ever in the City of Atlanta. And so a lot of this information that's come out before this new investigation, while the city is cooperating, is coming because she introduced the open checkbook, which means that citizens of Atlanta, anyone in the world, can go on a website and basically see the spending, all of the city departments. And I think the third thing here is that what really was in question, which, again, I'm not a lawyer, Sam is the information that they requested for this ongoing investigation. And by the way, the $90,000 that you referenced,
it was reimbursed.
It was reimbursed.
Yep.
But now it's a question on privilege. And is the information that the city turned over, which, again, for our listeners, it wasn't a hesitation to turn it over. They're not trying to hide it and not cooperate. But there was some redacted information about the information of the external lawyers that the city feels that due to privilege, they could not expose. And so now what the FAA is asking is that, well, can you give us more information that's not redacted?
And Sam Olens, you're an expert on open records and transparency. That was one of your themes as Attorney General. So what kind of position is the city in here?
So, Dennis, I need to skirt this question because I was retained by the city with regard to open records. So okay. I have a conflict. I apologize.
I tried to say as much as I could there.
Yeah. I appreciate it. But legally, I'm limited. I would simply repeat what Theron said, and that is that this mayor has had more than enough challenges in trying to get her administration off on the right foot and that I think she frankly deserves a lot of praise for all that she's been able to do with all these attacks.
As a veteran of state politics, though, let's move beyond the legal for just a moment. Is it your sense that this will spur further efforts in the legislature to have the state take over the airport?
Will individuals seek change? Yes. Will they be successful? Not on what's gone public so far.
And is the governor behind the city maintaining control of the airport, or do we know?
You know, I've heard the governor say that, you know, frankly, we should wait to see how the evidence comes out and we shouldn't be jumping to get involved prematurely.
One final note, we have to take notice of the passing of Toni Morrison, Nobel Prize-winning novelist who passed away just recently. And it happened, Theron, right after my wife and I had seen the movie, The Pieces I Am, the documentary, the kind of biography of Toni Morrison. Her impact, especially in a city headed by African-American leaders with an African-American university culture here. And I don't mean just say that that was the limit of her impact, but especially here. Toni Morrison, the loss of her is going to be felt for a long time, but the learning is going to be going on for generations.
Absolutely. And Toni Morrison was one of the most powerful voices, not only to the Black community, but to the world. Her impact on this country was noted by former presidents, and even our very own mayor took to social media and talked about the books.
Yeah, she had a photo, and I think it was Song of Solomon that was on top of her nightstand.
Absolutely, and so to your point, she's going to be extremely missed. All the many words in her writing and just her voice is never going to be replaced, and so we're definitely going to miss her.
Yeah, it's certainly my hope that, as Theron said, this is a learning opportunity to folks to learn more about her and more about her writings.
And clearly, the movie would be a good place to start. It's just amazing to see her and hear her voice and hear her thoughts.
Absolutely. You know, she was a treasure for our country, if not greater than our country, and we need to learn from her.
And that's it for this week's Political Breakfast. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Dennis O'Hare. Theron Johnson is a Democratic strategist, public affairs and government consultant, and former National Southern Regional Director for the Obama 2012 campaign. Filling in for Brian Robinson this time, former Georgia Republican Attorney General Sam Olens. He's also a former chair of the Cobb County Commission. Gentlemen, thank you so much. Thank you. Good to have you.
Thank you, Dennis.
And if you like this show, subscribe, and you can do that wherever you get your podcasts, and be sure to rate us. That's a great way to make sure that other people can find us. We'll be back in your feed and in your head soon with more nourishing political conversation. Be sure to join us.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
The Gold Dome Scramble podcast is now Plugged In, a WAB politics podcast. New name, same in-depth, on-the-ground reporting from us, WAB politics reporters Sam Greenglass and Raul Bally. We'll cover local, state, and national politics as we go beyond the headlines with journalists, voters, and politicians. New episodes drop Fridays starting April 26th. Listen and subscribe at WAB.org or your favorite podcast platform.